Hello and welcome to recording number 5 of Gary Gygax's Artifact of Evil, an annotated reading. Today is July 31st, 2021. We are starting on page 49, paragraph 2. We've just been hearing, there's just been a large fight, and the group of mercenaries and the more important leaders, such as Geller, Early Greenleaf, and Gord, have separated. So now there's one small group of about 10, and the mercenaries have left as cavalry. I'm going to restart on, like I said, paragraph 2, page 49. Greenleaf's audience stirred uneasily at this. But, pardon me, is my sound okay? All right, I'm going to start here. Greenleaf's audience stirred uneasily at this. The druid spoke on. It is an artifact of evil, an object of power, whose parts are threefold. One brings the powers of lawful evil into play, the second yokes neutral evil, and the last bonds chaotic evil and forms the whole. Once joined, these separate portions become a true artifact, and it has force far greater than its disjointed parts. Such is the rule of the multiverse. Every puzzle must have its parts, every riddle an answer, every lock a key. No solution must be simple by necessity of this immutable demand, but simple or near impossible, it is as it is. Thus the key to reawakening of Tharizdun is complex, scattered, and hidden. The concealment had been such that those who accomplished it had envisioned, but little prospect of it ever being comprehended, the object found and assembled. Being wise beyond our ken, though, they made provision should the unlikely occur. The provision we unearthed in due course, and its conundrum was revealed. The relic now resting with the Cabal may be known only at such time as the first of these three fragments of malign artifact comes into evil hands. No matter if good or evil wards the relic, whether or not law or chaos guards it, no use is possible unless its counterpart is active. Thus the bandits who saw the relic could speak only of seeing a treasure and nothing else. That we now possess and operate it bodes ill for the world. It goes without saying that all forces are involved. Evil in its three modes now works to bring the artifact into conjunction, intelligently, blindly, no matter, for powers beyond their gods and rulers now operate. Likewise, good makes common cause with concordant opposition, law with chaos. Should Tharizdun be roused from his ebon slumber, then only evil will remain when he ascends. Break. So we have an explanation of this key that will become an artifact if its three parts are joined together, or at least a much more powerful artifact. One of the things that I find interesting here is that the thought of neutral evil, lawful evil, chaotic evil, they have now become, instead of game mechanics or just game mechanics, they are now a philosophy within the Greyhawk setting, so that the alignment system, in perhaps in a little deviation from the game mechanics version, that is now a working philosophy that curly green leaf is expressing. He's saying that there's these forces of lawful evil, concordant opposition, chaotic evil, neutral evil, and that they're not just generalizations to come up with like moral philosophy in the gameplay. They are a moral philosophy within the Greyhawk campaign. So we can assume that a lot of things that Gygax is adding, I personally don't like it. I personally am not in favor of bringing in the alignment system as a moral philosophy into the Greyhawk setting. But now we can look at a lot of things that are used as game mechanics that make sense in the setting. If we look and say that we have like alignment languages and spells such as detect good, protection from evil, that has become a little more. It's become more than a mechanic the way that Gygax is describing it. Now, up till now, Gygax, alignment languages, they're silly. They really don't make much sense to me. And trying to use the bold-faced alignments as a moral philosophy, just, I don't know, I kind of cringe at that. Oh, yeah, and now, things like the merchant's language, where they give signs if they've been robbed to alert the watch, the thieves' cant. The thieves' cant is supposed to be something that was used in Victorian England. And there were other, kinds of these secret languages that were used. There was in England, at least, hobos and the men who wandered looking for charity from house to house, they would leave their own signs, to tell if there's, a good person there going to give them charity or somebody who's going to call the police. It's said that alignment is, if it's a philosophy, it seems to make no sense whatsoever to have an alignment language. And I am maybe jumping ahead here, because I get the feeling that there will be alignment language mentioned, but maybe not. So he hasn't mentioned it yet. I just find that right here, him bringing out alignment as something that Curly Greenleaf can talk about to everybody, and everybody seems to understand the concept of a chaotic evil alignment, of a neutral evil alignment. I find that just disconcerting, because I personally think it really shouldn't be part of the lore, but it should be, even if you're using it in the game setting as a mechanic, I think, okay, but I really don't like it as a part of the setting itself. Now, it's said here, the business of using the artifact as in separate pieces that be joined together, there are a number of early artifacts that are done this, the Rod of Seven Parts became a major, major box set in the game system. And then also the Imprisoned Gods. Well, that has happened quite a bit, and Gygax seemed to like that idea. I'm a little surprised. I mentioned this last recording that this is very early on and still a TSR book, and it brings up the whole Tharizdun thing. So I really wonder where Gygax would have gone with this if he had been still with TSR when he was writing the Gord books. wish that he had, say, written other stories not about Gord. Gord isn't actually my favorite character, especially the more powerful he becomes. It is always harder to keep things, in relatable balance when they get so super powerful. And Gord is becoming more and more powerful. It's mentioned that when you know too much, you lessen the wonder, and that is something that in writers or even game designers, they have to realize that the imagination leaves us with not only a perfect picture for our own selves, but it also, we create the monster, we create the wonder, is greater when it's our own imagination. And, this is something that I do preach on about keeping the imagination alive. It was something, it's one of the keys to what makes the Lovecraft material so powerful for people, is because he told as little as possible and left much more up to the imagination. So that's one of the things I've complained about, like with second edition materials that details so much, that I prefer the Gygaxian minimal detail. And even in his stories, I love not knowing and leaving it up to my own imagination to create. And I understand that's not for everybody, but for me, it's what makes the Greyhawk setting so special, because having to use your imagination makes it much more your own rather than using somebody else's imagination. So, but again, I find it a little disappointing to bring up these alignments directly as part of the story. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 49 and the final paragraph. How can little folk such as we hope to do what deities cannot? Rest assured, my good friends, that those far beyond our powers ask the same question. Still, the Hierophants of Kabal, Golden Dawn and Rosy Cruciform, stand ready to serve, as do high priests and art mages. The circles of each archdruid, the tiers of the Circle of Eight, high and low, prince and peasant, because evil musters its hordes, marshals its human servants, so likewise must all who oppose it gather to the standard. Perhaps the might of our six parts will be equal to the force of the tripartite evil, bolstered by the baneful sendings of Therizdan's comatose mind, and thus the key will be kept weak and disjointed, or perhaps not. That must be determined, at least in part, by what we do. So here I'm going to break, and I think this is the first mention of the Circle of Eight. Now, the circles are also part of Curly's druidic circles, but I'm pretty sure that this means the Circle of Eight that we all know and love. We have, jumping back, here's some commentary about how wonder is so important. And also, if we look at Lord of the Rings, we don't know what Sauron looked like. Tolkien only described Sauron as, he's a force, and he lost his physical body at one point, and he's a spirit force in the end. And in Greyhawk, it's said that the elder elemental gods should also be very mysterious. And yes, Now, for me, I tend to take the Elder Elemental God and add a lot of Lovecraftian mythos to him, or to it. And, you know, I find that, you know, that's very... seems to work very well where the shrines or shrines of Elder Elemental evil are very, you know, they're very mysterious. They're very distorting of reality. They cause nightmares and fear, and it works, you know, very well for me. So we also in this we're now given some an organization, the Hierophants of the Cabal. Of Cabal, and that's usually a, you know, Cabal's usually a organization, a secret religious society, and then we're told that one is called Golden Dawn and the other Rosy Cruciform. So we, you know, we're given a little bit of I think just Gygaxian lore there, because I don't think Golden Dawn and Rosy Cruciform are used outside of this novel or these novels. I'll have to look into that at some point. All right, so still we're getting, I mean, very unassuring, you know, reassuring message from Curly here, when, you know, he says, how can little folks such as we hope to do what deities cannot? And rest assured that those far beyond our powers ask the same question. I personally don't find that is just I personally don't find that very reassuring. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 50, paragraph 2. We have a mission. It has befallen on our little band to bear a heavy burden. I must explain this now, and then you must each decide whether or not you will accept. Geller rumbled in his deep in his chest, and then looked from face to face, studying each of the other listeners. I already know what our good druid is about to say, and I have made my choice. I am committed, just as Curly Greenleaf said, irrevocably bound to carry this task through until the end. I warn you all to consider the import of this. Make no pledge you will not keep unto death. Each of the men nodded in turn, as the one-eyed bard met their two eyes with his lone orb. The druid then resumed. Prisoner Gord was a monk, a monastic practitioner of martial arts involving body weaponry principally, rather than the arms we commonly employ. This was not just any such person. I tell you, not only was this man a master called North Wind, but he was high in the councils of the Scarlet Brotherhood. Being one wed to evil and lawfully oriented, this fellow quickly turned his coat in order to have his miserable life spared. All right. You know, it's commented here that the Elder Elemental God is, you know, kind of, it's an it. It's not genderless. And it is genderless. And it is, you know, it's a being that is very Lovecraftian, you know, one of these kind of elder things that Lovecraft always called as beyond time and space. All right. So, you know, what we've just gone through here is Geller, you know, going through and trying to... you know, it's pushing how, being explained here, how of deadly purpose this mission they all are in here. And reassure, you know, looking to reaffirm everybody's pledges and desires to continue. Because while some of them are, you know, definitely, like even Gord himself wouldn't necessarily want to go on such a life and death mission. But there's also several young druids. There's a tiger nomad, and there are three of the mercenaries who've sworn to go with them. One's a flan named Iconacy, and the other two are just regular mercenaries named Moon and Patrick. So they're all being asked to reaffirm their devotion to all this. And then we find out how important that monk was. I do wonder that evil and lawful would mean, I don't see exactly the connection an evil and lawful character would turn coat to save his life. And yes, there are, you know, we have our main characters, and then we have our we have our red shirts along to be casualties along the way. All right. You know, it wouldn't be exciting if somebody didn't die. So I'm going to we have, mention again of that this monk, the North Wind. I'm not sure that is an actual level title within the first edition Player's Handbook. But I'm not quite sure what level that is for a monk from the first edition. All right. It's commented here that the general idea of the evil is that he is a betrayer, even if he is lawful. It is the alignment system is rather, it's rather potboiler or pulp kind of thing, where there's not a lot of roundness to characters, which is one of the reasons I despise the alignment system, is that it seems to imply that everybody is in these, really definite, that they're kind of locked in the way that Star Trek would lock in, all Klingons are warriors, and they all followed the same, all Romulans were, the same, and, you never met the Klingon janitor, or, you never met the Klingon who was there, he was the cook, or, it really creates flat characters, and I always thought that alignment was more in the way of, for people who were just experimenting, just starting out really with characters, and it needed a way to make broad strokes, but that as time went on, you dealt more and more with rounded characters that could be different at different times and could have different reactions for different reasons. The way the NPCs are developed, it's commented here that they're like more driven by cosmic forces and more subjected to the pull of the alignments. But I think that as you develop as a DM and a player, you really discover that the characters are much more interesting if you do not slap alignments on them, that you slap consequences to their actions. So, that evil characters, they may do good, they may do evil, but what defines them is, it defines them in their major actions. They may do a lot of petty evil things, but it turns out that they do some majorly good things. They may be good to the people who are their family, their friends, their fellow countrymen, and absolutely evil to people who are not. And that is, you know, in the past, that was a common dichotomy. We're talking a lot about evil here, because honestly, this the first real mention of this kind of thing, and there's a lot here that we're looking over in this section that involves the evil. And I do see it is an important point here that Gygax is trying to take the concept of alignment and put it into as an outward working philosophy within the setting, so that you can talk about chaotic evil, and it is not just a gamey thing. It is an actual philosophy. Not my cup of tea, but certainly a lot of people really like the alignment system and use it. So here's one version, Gygax's version of it, bringing it right out into the story and into the lore, you know, to be seen and used. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 50 and the last paragraph. It is no secret that the Brotherhood of the Scarlet Sign is evil and serves evil. However, we did not understand until now just how devoted it is. The order itself mimics the basis of ultimate wickedness. Consider how the lowest and largest portion of the Brotherhood consists of chaotic-minded thieves. Above them are the assassins, indifferent to all save evil. Above all are the monks. These leaders are precise and orderly, organizing and planning, controlling the spread of malign power. What Master North Wind revealed, he did not realize. We, aware of events beyond his perspective, did. On the surface, the cause of the Brotherhood is to elevate the Sulis race to its so-called rightful position as masters of all humankind. Now, red-clad soldiers march from Spine Ridge below the vast swamp westward, some 700 miles to the waters of the Denzac Gulf. Ships of the Brotherhood bring their tyranny to the Olman Islands, the shores of Hepmonaland, and the Pomarj. Ostensibly, this was to place pale-eyed Sulis overlords to the rule the lesser humans. The true purpose of their movements is now revealed. The Scarlet Sign serves Tharizdun above all other of their evil deities. Somehow the leaders of the Brotherhood, not just monks, but wicked clerics, cavaliers, magic users, all have conspired to find and unite the scattered portions of the artifact which will free their god and bring his ultimate evilness upon all life. Perhaps they see that even total evil must have some structure and look to form it. I know not. Whatever their reasoning or rationale, they have labored in darkness to bring forth this malign thing. Scarlet Brother holds the first part of the artifact somewhere within their lands. Break. So here we have the, you know, the revelation that the most important worship is Tharizdun, and the rest, the Sul Pantheon, falls somewhat under that. Now, we're also told that their entire structure is based on, you know, mechanically under the Thieves class, because I believe, you know, and I should know this, but all three, Thief, Assassin, and Monk, I believe are all listed under Thief as, you know, the two as subclasses. So it is interesting that the head, the leader of Strandkeep Castle that they just conquered was actually a cleric, but he was a cleric of Tharizdun. The Scarlet Brotherhood monk was not the leader, and that he would betray them to save his own life. It strikes me as a little strange, especially for a monk, But so here, we're actually getting quite a bit. Now, I believe originally under the national alignment chart found in, what, the folio or the 83-box set, that the Scarlet Brotherhood was lawful neutral. I might be mistaken, but I've heard that recently. And here we're having them actually as lawful evil. And unlike what was happening with the Greyhawk Wars, where the Scarlet Brotherhood is coming out to rule, that instead they're coming out to actually revealing themselves here, according to Gygax, to aid in, they've gotten hold of the first part of what's called the Theopart, the tripartite artifact that is the key to releasing Tharizdun. And now they're looking to find the other parts and assemble them. So here we have this Scarlet Brotherhood sending out soldiers and, bringing their tyranny to the Olmen Islands, Hepmonaland, Palmarj, and, they're coming from Spine Ridge in the vast swamp where where their base is, and they're doing it not for conquest, but for discovery of these parts. So I can see where if you remove the Tharizdun thing, you might say from the Scarlet Brotherhood source book that came out for second edition, and for what happened in the wars, they were going more for expansion. So I think this may be, looking on this, this may be where part of the ideas expressed in the second edition Greyhawk Wars box set may have come from these ideas by Gygax. Now, this was published in 87, and I believe Gygax was already gone from the company when this came out. So, it is something that I believe that they have delved into, the people who were with TSR post-Gygax delved into to use for the, expanding Greyhawk campaign setting. And it's surprising. This really starts in Artifact of Evil, the expansion and turning into great amounts of information about Tharizdun and expansion of on what we knew of the Scarlet Brotherhood. Whether this can just be seen, this isn't meant to be. It's very interesting seeing the information. This is a lot of added detail and also, small bouts to small bits and pieces of information and lore to add to titillate and inspire the imagination. But here we are hearing a little more and in a little different way about the Scarlet Brotherhood. And so, it's commented that the SB Scarlet Brotherhood territory is listed as lawful neutral, but here we have Gygax saying, nope, they're evil through and through. They're lawful evil, but they're evil. All right. Finally we have that the Brother Scarlet Sign serves Tharizdun above all other of their evil deities. So, whatever Soulish pantheon, you just seems to be that Tharizdun may be at the top of the Soul pantheon, or he may be a leftover of an older deity. And it's hard to tell. I mean, because the Scarlet Brotherhood is actually a society, it's asked here, is the Scarlet Brotherhood just a small group within that whole society of, all the people who are not monks, who are not assassins, who are just the normal soldiers, who are just the normal people. I mean, it's hard to say because we haven't been told exactly how the Scarlet Brotherhood and the people, who live there are, what kind of society they have. So, It could be that the bulk of the people in that area are lawful neutral, but the actual monks and thieves and the members are lawful evil. But, you know, we're still have to see how Gygax, and of course all that is just simply up to what the individual DM wants it to be. Now, it does sound in a way it could be something like the old Spartan, where, you know, the Spartans had about 20 slaves for every Spartan. And the Spartans lived like a very elite group, where the men were warriors, the women were trained to fight, and they also, you know, and they had to do the work to raise the crops, to do their washing for them. They had this huge amount of slaves. And, you know, it could be that is the makeup of the Scarlet Brotherhood society over there, you know, in, I believe it's the Tilvanot Peninsula. It could be that they have a society of people who are very much slaves or serfs, or very, very different from than the Scarlet Brotherhood itself. Yeah, and you know, it's like the U.S. Special Forces, it's commented, is, you know, heavily associated, you know, with the country, but they're an elite group, very small, you know, a minuscule amount of men belong to those various Special Forces groups, and they do not represent the society as a whole. So the alignment of this group may be for a very small amount of people in the Scarlet Brotherhood, but the entire country does not necessarily follow it. There were historically, there were very few countries that were what would be termed as just evil, which is, you know, even at the end of World War II, it was decided that a lot of people were, you know, had to be forced into the Nazi party, and where the actual adherents to it were a smaller group. But, you know, that, you know, it's hard to say, make a judgment call on something like that. You know, it was very convenient to have people say that they were forced into a situation when there was a lot of out-and-out evil going on in, so it's very hard to say. It's mentioned here that in the private campaign that the Scarlet Brotherhood is secret even to most of the people in the Tilvanot society there, where they come from. And yeah, you know, there is not a lot of definitive information, so we are really open within 1E. Now, in 2E, there's more published material, and then, you know, it gets harder for people to ignore what's been written, even if it's, you know, kind of a conflict to their own campaign. And for other people, it's, you know, actually no problem whatsoever that the published material is, you know, just like a serving suggestion, and you go your own way. So, you know, the makeup of this society is really, at this point in 1987, it is very open. And for you to have done anything with it as a DM, you would have had to make it up yourself. Now, this is why the Gord book is reveals so much. It adds so much to the campaign, because even these sparse details, they had not come out at the time. And this was all a revelation about Tharizdun, about the Scarlet Brotherhood. There are, you know, in all these books, about 2,500 pages of material. And, you know, they did start going into the time when Sargent was detailing things, because it goes past the TSR period. But, yeah, I mean, this is a lot of new new information about, what's going on with the Scarlet Brotherhood and, who Tharizdun is. As somebody who's, a campaign devastating deity, it's very important to find out what happens. I just wonder if Gygax had stayed with TSR, whether he would have taken the Tharizdun in the Gord campaign books. I am going to restart. It's page 51 and paragraph 4. Early Greenleaf paused, licked his lips, and then called on his listeners. Now, each of you must swear allegiance to the others of this band and pledge to keep its quest until completed or death ends the obligation, or else you must now leave our company and never more be part of it. This was something Gord could understand and be moved by, a task with meaning, a reason beyond his own existence. He was the first to make his oath. The three lesser druids followed naturally. Then the Chakyak Jakote grinned broadly and made his commitment with nonchalance. After all, what tiger fears death, he said easily. Inkose pledged, probably as much in hatred of the Seul as to confound evil. Only the two fighters, Moon and Patrick, remained unspeaking. All eyes turned toward them. Moon stood up and spoke. I gotta speak for both of us, 'cause Patrick ain't much for doing so himself. He and me is just ordinary sorts. Guys who decided carrying a spear would be a better way to earn a living than pushing a plow or something like that. We ain't much in anyone's book, you know. We're both pretty much satisfied to do our duty and let be otherwise. Moon cleared his throat nervously, shuffled a bit, and then managed to go on. What I guess I'm saying for both of us is that we really didn't suppose you'd want a couple of little nobodies like us two on a deal like this. If it's us you want, though, you better believe we're with the gang until it's over. With that, he sat down, blushing at having said so much. Silent Patrick and proud Comrade Moon were both sworn to the quest, and the band numbered 10. Break. Now here's a, before I get to that section, here's a commentary. And that the, in another campaign, the Scarlet Brotherhood is like a whisper network, very private and very unknown. The overall bent of the country might be lawful neutral, but from the perspective of the citizens of the Scarlet Brotherhood lands, they're just people trying to live their lives. Most of them do not really have much to do with the whisper network or part of the Scarlet Brotherhood organization. And, that is, again, that is, really showing, how the Tilvanot people then have a functioning society, and the Scarlet Brotherhood are, a regular part of that. And, that fits in really well with a lot of the things going on. For myself, I have it as a much more overt society that has a kind of a generally serf population, not slaves. In that they do have slaves in my campaign, but not for the overall population. But the overall population is cowed and very well aware of the Scarlet Brotherhood, and that's from my campaign. And then they choose the strongest, and then they have these contests to find people who would be best at being warriors or, would qualify as thieves or assassins to kind of draw upon that strength. But at the same time, most of the people, even though they're part of that land, they and don't have any control over what they're doing, the rulers are definitely the Scarlet Brotherhood, and that's my campaign. The other way here, looking at it, is that there is a society of which the Scarlet Brotherhood is kind of parasites upon that society, you know, of these souls living in the Tilvanot Peninsula, and that the Scarlet Brotherhood is maybe the power behind their leaders, but they're hidden still, even within that society. And that makes a lot of sense to me, because I always see them more like the Illuminati, they're a powerful secret organization. But I do like having them in my campaign for the General Flaness, but in their own society, they kind of relax down to this, very restrictive, where they're ruling the way they'd like to have ruled and thought that they would have ruled in Old Sewell. So now, getting back to this section, one of the things that they're all swearing in, and it shows some, very abruptly, but all of them want to swear to this and join this party. I'm sorry. Is the sound going? Okay, that's the second time. Right, is the sound still out? 5 seconds. All right, I am using the old Chromebook, because there was mention that there was problems with the sound that I thought might be the laptop. I would just have to experiment and see. All right. Now, one of the things that I was saying, was that we see here that all the 10 members of this have all now sworn. But again, it's a little hard when reading Gygax is again using this almost like early 20th century vernacular, almost like Chicago gangsters and it's a little hard to read because it's done in a certain way where there's a lot of contractions and a lot of colloquial versions of the like almost accented. And it's always difficult to switch into accented talk for me at least. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 52 and the third paragraph. Just to remind you, if it does look like I've missed something, please bring it up. And also, if there's something that in that missing silence that needs to be elaborated on, that I was starting or cut off in the middle of this thing, and it was about Moon and Patrick. What I was saying was that Moon and Patrick are. It's the way Gygax was using the language seemed jumping back to things he did a lot in Saga of Old City, where they were kind of speaking in a Chicago gangster patois. Your comment about Moon and Patrick, I'm sorry. All right. And if you want to repeat that, I'm offhand. What that comment was. All right, I'm going to start reading again, but if you want to type that in. All right. Yeah. And here it is commented that Moon and Patrick, Gygax has them as being a bit of an imposter syndrome, that they're not worthy, but they commit wholeheartedly. And yes, it does show a certain type of thinking. And it's, that isn't part, really, I think, of modern thinking. It was part of, Gygax's probably reading, of past history, of that these guys were thought of themselves as simple soldiers. So that's, not something that I think is really thrust forward today as much, but it is very believable that these two would find themselves among the company of heroes. And this is a heroic game. I mean, that's something that I think people always, you know, miss about one aspect of, I think it's what people miss about one aspect of AD&D is that it's supposed to be a game of heroes a lot of times, not necessarily superheroes, but people who are actual heroes. And that doesn't mean that the character is super powerful. Heroics is simply people willing to stand up, and especially people like Moon and Patrick, who aren't as strong or experienced or, you know, as high level with more abilities, like, you know, Curly and Geller and Gord. You know, it takes, if you aren't worried about things, you can't be brave. And if you can't be brave, you can't really be a hero. A hero risks his life, and a hero is afraid, but goes ahead and does the things anyway. So if you're not fearful, if you're not worried about getting hurt, if you're just going to go headlong into something, that's not exactly heroics. So, yeah, you know, I always think about the comment from the movie Kelly's Heroes. You know, to you, a hero is just some funny kind of sandwich. So, you know, these are, these men, especially, even more than Gord, who is strong with magical weapons, Moon and Patrick are very heroic. You know, they're very proud to have been brought among this company of very powerful individuals. All right. I'm going to run through this because we're coming to close of paragraph four, chapter four here, and let's see if we can do it. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 52, and it is paragraph three. Now the druid told them, "I can say that our mission is to find the second part of the artifact before the Scarlet Brotherhood does. This heavy burden comes upon us because we are the nearest and most capable force to do so. Others could be sent for, but what reaction would this bring from the enemy? They think their secret safe for now, and we must not give them reason to suppose otherwise until it is too late for them to do anything about it." Break. All right, I'm keep breaking in, but this expressed right here is one of the things about the game and why you would have lesser, lower experience level characters dealing with situations when somebody like Mordenkainen, supposedly so powerful, could come in and deal with it, you know, with a snap of his fingers. Because if Mordenkainen does this, the forces opposing Mordenkainen may be brought forth to, you know, look on it. So here it's, you know, you might have in your game characters, your player characters being called upon to do things that might be easier done by the person calling them about. But for one reason or another, they can't do it. You know, Mordenkainen, just to keep using him as an example, he could be busy doing something else, and this is just too much for him to do. He has these other important things that are maybe even beyond the abilities of anyone else to do. And so he's bringing in your characters, and it's a reason to have them summoned to do quests. And, you know, it is just, it is a really excellent idea and a show of what you can do and why you can have these powerful, you know, these powerful NPCs in the game call upon the lesser, your characters who are much lesser in power to go up against what is possible for them to accomplish. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 52 and paragraph 5. In questioning Master North Wind and examining the papers he so readily gave over to save his life, we discovered a clue that makes the Brotherhood's activity in the Pomarge meaningful. What the servants of the Red Abomination thought was that the next portion was located within the Drakenscrabs, buried deep under Worm's Jaws, but actually it is probably hidden within the confines of the Sus. Perhaps now the Brotherhood has learned that we know what we know. Their Castilian, the cleric elder brother of the Order, had just discovered that his superiors had been wrong. He kept this information from all others, desiring to bring it himself to the Oldest, as they call their supreme leader, to gain personal benefit. The assault of Prince Ulloch's army wrenched his machinations severely. At the last, he managed, just barely, to send a messenger to the Brotherhood. That one will probably arrive in Crow Turlop soon, not knowing the true import of his message. The captive monk did not, but the leaders of the Scarlet Brotherhood will certainly understand, and they will hasten to make amends for their past error by sending agents to steal the second portion quietly. If they suspected our band was even now making for the same objective, their reaction would be massive and most terrible. By risking ourselves, we spare thousands. We are the hope against evil, and we must not fail. Break. All right, this is the end of chapter 4 right here. And so, we have this summing up of, of where the story's going. Now, here's a comment about the worship of Tharizdun. The Scarlet Brotherhood book says they spread that rumor to create fear in their enemies. However, they are interested in Tharizdun's sites and artifacts for the power and magic. And finally, there's a comment. If Gord is part of our hope against evil, we're truly farked. And I don't want to jump ahead, but things do not turn out all rosy. So we get, this is, it's very interesting. We get this, information about the second artifact being in the Sus Forest. And it is one of the, the rumors. Am I right in remembering that there's supposedly a lost Sul City in the Sus Forest? I believe, yes. So, that was one of, I think, the little bits that was mentioned in either, I think it might have been just in the 83 box set about, or it might have been in the folio as well about the Sus Forest, or it might have been about the section for potential adventures. I can't remember which offhand. So here, we're redirected. And again, this business of how important Tharizdun was. So in the Scarlet Brotherhood book that came out for 2E, they were influenced by this information, but they, again, took their own tack, and they went, they went with the idea that... instead of going that they're after Tharizdun, which, with the way, it goes, Tharizdun is the destruction of all things. He's the Sutekh of, if you know Doctor Who, he's the Sutekh of the Greyhawk campaign. And if he wins, everything's destroyed. So, they instead, and I don't have a lot of complaints about that concept. I have a lot of complaints about what they ended up doing with the Scarlet Brotherhood, but that's really, in bringing them out into the open so much. I really do like, I like the idea, that the Scarlet Brotherhood, as has been brought up, that even within the Tilvanot Peninsula, that they're a secret. It's not how I run it, but I like that idea. And I dislike the idea that they would at any time come out in the open. I don't think that it makes sense that they would reveal themselves just because of the wars and then be out there, you know, visibly, you know, that this is the Scarlet Brotherhood. And, you know, at this point, they're such a secret society, and I find that a wonderful concept and a lot you can do with it. I think it makes sense. I don't think they have the power to be a, a nation conquering. Not unless they were like secretly behind the Great Kingdom or one of the larger or more of the bigger nations. I can't see how the Scarlet Brotherhood could just come out and be these conquering forces. They are, you know, even Gygax thought that they would come out and be involved in Hetmana Land, and, you know, where they would have a better chance of using their limited sources to benefit themselves. But I think if it was kind of like army for army, I doubt, like here, the Prince of Uluk is able to destroy their strongest fortress in the Pomarj. And I think that is exactly something that would drive them deeper underground than have them come out even further. All right, well, that was the end of chapter number 4. And so I'm going to call up the Craig bot, which has been perhaps for one reason or another having a few problems tonight. But there's a lot, so many possibilities of what could be going wrong. But I'm going to call up Craig and end it for tonight. And I will be back on tomorrow.